If you'll open your Bibles to Mark chapter 5. We have been studying the works of Jesus, the miracles of Jesus. We saw last time the stilling of the storm, and we left off last week with 13 men soaked to the skin, dumbfounded over the amazing work of Christ where he commanded the wind and the waves and they instantaneously stopped. Now the sky is clear, the water is calm, the air is still, and the boat just comes gliding into the shore on the other side. Now, I actually forgot to put the map out today. I was going to show you the Sea of Galilee. It's interesting that they went to the other side because that's out of Israel. We don't know if this whole thing that we're going to look at this morning took place that same night after that long, hard day, or if this is the next day. Maybe they got a little sleep on the beach and then this happens the next morning. We don't know. But whenever they could get there and take a look around and see where they were on that beach, they would find themselves in one of the most unclean, defiling contexts imaginable. This is really an eerie scene. Look at verse 1 of Mark 5. They went across the lake into the region of the Gerasenes. Jesus has reached a point in his ministry of fierce rejection by almost everyone. The spiritual leaders in Israel, all the way to his own family, has completely rejected him. And this is a fairly drastic, dramatic thing that we see him crossing the lake, because he's not just crossing a lake, he's crossing a border. He's leaving Israel. So we have this massive rejection, and then Jesus leaves the country and goes into the area of the Decapolis, which is a Gentile area. Greeks lived there mostly. And Greeks were never on good terms with the Jews. Now, Jesus had done some unheard of things for a rabbi already, but at this time, he really outdoes even himself. For the Jews, it was defiling just to be in Gentile territory, on Gentile soil. And in the Jewish lists of the things that defile you, right at the top, number one on the list, was a dead body. And guess where they end up on the beach? As they pull up onto the shore, they come right into the area, a cemetery, a group of caves. And they found these caves now. They just put these dead bodies in the caves and left them there. And they used them for tombs. This is an extremely distasteful story so far as the Jewish mind reads this. Not only that, on the hillside we're grazing a herd of 2,000 pigs. And that's really not kosher. And between the caves and the pigs, you can imagine, this place must have stunk to high heaven and been a great illustration of how unclean it was to them religiously. And if that's all that isn't defiling enough, in a minute we're going to be introduced to a guy who lived in the tombs around those dead bodies and went around completely naked and had unclean spirits living in him. For the Jews, the Holy of Holies was the place of God's dwelling. The closer you approach to it, the holier the ground you are on. So spiritually speaking, you could scarcely get any farther from God's place of favor than this place. Jesus has led his 12 men right into the darkest depths of the most contaminating, defiling uncleanness you can imagine. Now verse 2, when Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an unclean spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. This man has an unclean spirit. Now, having an unclean spirit, your Bible might say evil spirit, literally unclean spirit, that means to, what that is an evil spirit, a demon, comes inside you and takes control. Now imagine what that would be like. Imagine what it's like for this guy. Probably none of you have been demonized, so we just have to imagine. But just think of it. Think of your worst enemy. Think of an ultimately evil being who has nothing but hatred for you and wants nothing other than your total destruction and is very powerful. Imagine a being like that having control over your body. What would it be like? Verse 3 says he lived in the tombs. They made him live right there in the caves with the decaying corpses. Luke says that for a long time the man had not worn any clothes. Total humiliation and degradation. Stripped of all dignity. Demons despise the image of God and they want to destroy it and humiliate it. Verse 5, he would cry out, literally shriek, and cut himself with stones. And we're going to see in a moment that this man has superhuman strength and he's injuring himself with stones, cutting himself. The demons are trying to destroy him. And his wounds, of course, would go unattended. His body was a mass of lacerations and infections and scar tissue and scabs. In his mind, a delirium of pain and sanity, and in his lucid moments, must have realized how repulsive he was and that everybody regarded him as subhuman. Verse 4, he had often been chained hand and foot and kept under guard, says Luke, and he tore the irons apart. Apparently the demons would come upon him in episodes, and when he wasn't having an episode, they could chain him. Now, Jesus had just got done saying the day before, or earlier this day, that if you have seven demons, that's far worse than having just one demon. We're going to find in a minute that this man has thousands of demons in him. So imagine what life was like for him. During the episodes where they would seize him, his life would be unimaginable. Misery, the greatest possible degradation, humiliation, physical pain, and emotional pain. When he wasn't having an episode of being seized, he would be bound and shackled as tightly as they could and just left there. He was despised and feared. No doubt not shown love by anybody. His life would have been a disaster. And life for the community wasn't roses either. Verse 5, day and night among the tombs, he would cry out. He's just loose. The guy's running loose. That probably the reason they bound him is for their own safety, the safety of the community. Matthew says there was a second guy with him. And they were so violent that nobody could pass that way. I guess not. They're not going to go anywhere near there. They can't even go in that area. Some of you are concerned about your own children. You've heard about the abduction attempt in Erie, and you're concerned about that guy, you know, where, if he's still around or whatever. Can you imagine if this guy were in your neighborhood? I mean, just picture that. Every time you saw any movement at night, or you could hear these shrieks, or you'd be scared to death. Nothing anybody could do about it. I mean, just being in a graveyard at night in our modern day is enough to give most people the willies. This is really something. Imagine what it was like. They pull up the boat onto the shore, and the disciples, picture them, they're scurrying around, tying up the boat, securing it to the shore, whatever, maybe glancing behind them. They can't help it with their curiosity, looking up in the blackness at those caves. And suddenly, out of the darkness comes bone-chilling shrieks, demonic screams that must have curdled their blood. And here comes this maniac, charging down the hill, running, without any clothes, screaming, superhuman strength, maniacal, a man with who could smash irons apart and shackles to pieces. And here he comes. This is worse than the storm. I mean, they're out of the frying pan into the fire here. I don't know what the disciples did. Maybe someone wanted to duck back into the boat or try and find a place to go or get behind Jesus. I don't know what they did, but Jesus doesn't do anything. He doesn't even move. He stays right there. This guy's charging straight at him, and Jesus doesn't move. He just stands there, and the guy does not stop running until he gets right up to Jesus. And then, verse 6, when he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. Literally, proskuneo, that's the word for worship. He fell down, prostrated himself, and worshiped. The demon is worshiping Christ. You say, what kind of worship is that? Is that adoration? No, it's not adoration. His demon does not adore Jesus. He hates Jesus. It may be an attempt to get some mercy from Jesus, as we'll see in a minute. It may be, I don't know, just almost involuntary homage of a creature collapsed at the feet of his creator. But it's not adoration. Look at verse 7. He's still shouting. He shouted at the top of his voice. All three Gospels mention the fact that he's shouting at this point, the top of his voice. He's there with his face in the dirt, bowed before Jesus, worshiping and screaming. When demons worship, it's just as grotesque as everything else they do. You say, that sounds weird. Well, it is weird. It's bizarre. It's just the unnatural viciousness of this demon who recognizes that he's confronted with one who's superior to him, and his knees buckle, but he's still screaming. And at this point, Jesus, we find in verse 8, it's interesting, if you look carefully, Jesus at this point commands the demon to go out. But he doesn't. Now that's odd. We've never seen that before. Every other time Jesus commands a demon to go, he goes instantly. This demon stays and answers back at Jesus. He says, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" Screaming at the top of his voice. Now the demon knows exactly who he's dealing with, the Son of the Most High God. Nobody has to give him a lesson on Christology. He recognizes the Son of God when he sees him. He remembers being created by him and then being cast out of heaven by him. On the lake, remember the disciples asked, "What kind of man is this? Who is this man?" Here they get their answer. He's the Son of the Most High God. Which is interesting. Seems like that's a favorite title for spiritual beings, for Christ. That's a demon in Acts 16 calls him Son of the Most High God, or for God, the Most High God. The angel Gabriel uses that term when he refers to God in Luke 1. Anyway, this demon knows who Christ is. His Christology is intact. And his eschatology is on track too. In Matthew's account, he says, "What do you want with us, Son of God?" They shouted, "Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time?" This demon was pre-mill. He knows the order of events. This is not judgment. This can't be judgment day yet. And yet he sees the Messiah getting out of the boat. And he thinks, "Oh no, what are you doing here?" Well, at this point the demon seems to be emboldened. Maybe he realized, "Hey, he told me to get out and I'm still here." And he gets up a little courage and he decides to confront Jesus. Verse 7, look what he says in verse 7. "Swear to God that you won't torture me." Now literally, he says, "I adjure you by God." And that's hard for us because we're not used to oaths. But he's trying to bind Jesus with an oath. He's trying to put him under an oath. The language invokes a curse on Jesus if Jesus doesn't comply. That's the idea. If you torture me now, may God torture you. As if God is going to curse his own son. They're trying to pull a power play on the Son of the Most High God here. Amazing. I don't know what happened. Maybe a particularly powerful demon steps forward at this point. One who has never felt the sting of Jesus' rebuke and anger before. And he thinks he can intimidate Jesus. Sounds strange, sounds bizarre. But before you laugh at that, just picture the scene. I want you to imagine it. Jesus is in their territory. They know he's God, but it must have been obvious to them that Jesus is in his humanness was weak and tired and exhausted. And remember, demons are extraordinarily powerful beings, very dangerous beings. In Isaiah 37, one angel killed 185,000 Assyrians, wiped out the whole army in one night without any trouble. One angel. And we know that demons are comparable to angels in strength because remember in Daniel 10, Jesus dispatched that angel on a task and a demon held him up and he couldn't get past until the archangel came and helped him. So demons are that powerful too. Jesus asked him in verse 9, "What is your name?" And he says, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Jesus didn't need to know his name. He asked the question for our benefit so that we would know that this man has more than just one demon. He has a legion of demons. Now, think of this word legion, what this would call to mind. A Roman legion was 6,000 foot soldiers and 120 horsemen and a considerable number of technical personnel. So the term legion would have called to mind not only great numbers, but also efficient organization and formidable, relentless force. Now just change the lenses on your eyes and look at this scene at the spiritual level and see what's going on here spiritually. There's Jesus and the 12 in their weak, limited, human, tired bodies. And surrounding them were thousands of evil, vile, powerful, vicious demons. Each one of those demons perfectly capable of killing or injuring. So just picture the scene. Imagine this. There's Jesus. These 12 guys, they're standing there, and there are thousands of demons all over the hillside and the boat and the water, all over the place. They're surrounded. And every last one of them, immensely powerful. Far more powerful than Jesus in his human nature. Every one of them filled with violent hatred for Christ and the 12. This is dangerous. And they have Jesus on their territory, in their home turf, with every advantage, and they decide they're going to challenge him. This is quite a showdown here. A literal army of demons versus the Messiah. This is the fight of the century. What could be more dramatic? This is a power encounter of absolutely cosmic proportions. Now, the Jews of Jesus' time had prescribed methods just like people today for casting out demons. They said if you follow these incantations and follow these formulas and the right phrases and all this, then you can get some advantage on the demon. Matthew 8:32 tells us how Jesus finally cast these demons out, and he tells us the terminology he used. Just one word, go. No incantations, no formulas, no effort. They just go. And they're gone. Every last one of them, gone. So much for the battle of the century. Big letdown. He utters one word, and a legion of the most powerful beings in the universe stumble all over each other in a mad scramble to get out of this guy. The man's instantly free of demons. This is a display of divine authority that is hard to describe. I think it's more awesome even than what he did on the lake. And it's interesting, it's significant that he did these kinds of miracles, because in 1 John 3:8, there's a very, very important verse that says, the reason the Son of God appeared was... Now, anytime you read a verse and it starts out that way, that's going to make you perk up, right? I mean, we're curious. The reason the Son of God appeared? Why? What is the reason the Son of God appeared? The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. It's a major part of the reason why he came. Someday, Jesus is going to eliminate all evil. He's going to eradicate it. And he did things like this to prove his ability to do that. A lot of people stress over the question of the origin of evil. Why does God allow so much evil? Why does he allow the evil in my life? Why does he allow so much pain in my life or in the lives of the people around me? And why the horrible things going on around the world? I mean, we just see... Just this week, the news was just... I mean, it's just crippling almost to listen to the news. I was listening about the deal in South Africa where there's an epidemic of AIDS. Evidently now there's a belief there that AIDS can be cured by having relations with a virgin, and so they're raping little girls over there. This year, or last year alone, 21,000 cases. The most recent one, a 6-week-old baby. Keep in mind, these rapists are... people who have AIDS, giving it to these children. You hear stuff like that, and it just boggles the mind. How could God allow that kind of evil to exist? Where did it come from? And we hear that, and people are troubled about the fact that God ever allowed evil, and there's no end to the books that have been written and the theories about the origin of evil and why God allowed it, all that, and that's an interesting thing to pursue. But really, if you ask me, the whole question of the origin of evil is moot. Whatever the reason was, there's no question about it. It exists, right? I mean, it's here. And frankly, I'm not so much worried about the origin of evil. My concern is about the future of evil, right? That's more important to me. I want it gone. I don't like it. And I long for things to be set right. I want to live in a place where there is no evil. None of any kind. I did a little study of Gautama Buddha, who was a remarkable man. But did he ever give any evidence of being able to eradicate evil from the universe? No. Muhammad? Joseph Smith? Those men weren't even able to eradicate the evil of their own hearts, much less that of everyone else. Only one person has been able to prove his power, his ability to eliminate evil, and it was the Lord Jesus Christ, God Almighty in human flesh. And for him, he can not only do it, but it's so easy, it just takes one word. Go. So he can cast them all out, and that's great. But why the delay? Why doesn't he make them go right away, the first time? Is he having trouble here? What's he doing? Well, he had something very specific in mind. He did that for a reason, and it's begins to unfold here in verse 10. Look at verse 10. Look at the demon's plea. He begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. This courageous stand that they're taking against Jesus didn't last long, and Matthew tells us why. They are concerned about something very specific. They begged him repeatedly not to order them to go to the abyss. That's what they're concerned about. Please, please, please don't send us there. Anything but that. Don't send us there. Don't torture us yet. All three accounts of this mention their panic over the prospect of being tortured by Christ. That's why demons always get so panicked when they saw Jesus, because they know when the Messiah comes, they're going to get sent to the abyss and tortured by him. Now, what is the abyss? It's an interesting word. If you look it up, it's actually not a noun. It's just really an adjective. It just means bottomless. They said, don't send us to the bottomless. The abyss is a terrible place with no bottom. You just keep descending. It just keeps getting worse and worse forever. Now, some people believed it was at the bottom of the sea. Other people believed it was in the middle of the earth. Wherever it was believed to be the place where demons were confined. And this was a belief that the Jews had developed in between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And when the New Testament arrived, it turns out the people were right about that. It seems that the New Testament confirms the idea that there are some demons who are free to go and do whatever they want, and there are other demons who are confined and bound. And the place they're bound is in the abyss. You get a hint of that in 1 Peter 3:19. Here we learn it's a place of torture for them. A demon would rather go through any agony than go there. It's a horrible place. And you say, well, is it ever described in the Bible? And the answer is yes, it is. In Revelation chapter 9, gives us some idea about what it's like. We don't get to see in there, but we get to see what comes out of there. An angel is given the keys to the abyss in Revelation 9 and opens up the top, and you don't even want to know what comes out of there. I mean, it's right out of some kind of a horror movie. It is. There's some smoke that escapes along with some creatures that are unbelievable. They're described as being like locusts, which have to be the most hideous things in existence. A locust. I don't know if you ever looked close at one of those things. But these things are like locusts, except they're worse than regular locusts because they're the size of a horse. Imagine a horse-sized locust with tails that sting like scorpions. I've never been stung by a scorpion, and I'm not an expert on scorpions, but I can tell you with some authority that a horse-sized scorpion sting is bad. They have a face like a human, a woman's hair. They have long hair and wings and tails, and they come out mad. Like a demon out of hell, literally. These demons know what that place is like. These demons on that hillside know that place. And they are terrified at the prospect of going there, and so they beg. And that must have been something for the disciples to witness. I mean, all their lives, they've heard about the abyss, they've read about it and whatever, just like we have, but it must have seemed kind of imaginary. Now, all of a sudden, they're standing there on the beach with some beings who know that place, have experienced something of that place, are terrified of it. I mean, this is real. And they're also standing there on the beach next to someone who has the authority to send demons there or to loose demons from there. This is just amazing. And now the story takes an even more bizarre turn. Look at verse 11. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. And the demons begged Jesus, send us into among the pigs so that we can go into them. You know, it's funny because with man, if you've ever heard of anybody tell a story about casting out demons, with man it's always a question of if the demon will come out. With Jesus, that was never the question. They were coming out. The only question is they want to know where they're allowed to go. They're going. They just need to find out where they have permission to go. And look at the Lord's response, verse 13. He gave them permission. And the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number. Now picture that. 2,000 pigs. How much space does 2,000 pigs take up? I don't know. I've never seen 2,000 pigs. It seems to me, I was trying to picture this, 2,000 pigs. I mean, that would have, like, this whole area between here and Highway 42, I bet you it would take up that whole space, at least. This is a lot of pigs. 2,000 pigs, they all of them rush down the steep bank into the lake where they were drowned. 2,000 pigs, just like a jump in the lake, die. That's incredible. I mean, you picture this scene? These pigs are just there, calmly grazing, just oinking around, doing whatever pigs do, and they're out. And then all of a sudden they just run into the lake and die. Just imagine what it's like to be standing, these disciples who are watching all. I mean, their eyes must just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger as they're seeing this. First they arrive at these tombs, then this maniac comes screaming up to Jesus, then he falls down on his face and he's worshiping while screaming. Then the demons try to intimidate Jesus, but Jesus easily overwhelms them. Then these docile, normal pigs instantly turn into demonized, maniacal pigs, and then they all jump into the lake and drown. What a scene! This is not just another routine day of ministry. So we have two questions here. First of all, why do these demons want to go into the pigs? And second of all, why does Jesus let them? Why does he grant them their request? The first question, why do they want to go? The text doesn't say. We can make some educated guesses. Remember the day before, Jesus had said in Matthew 12:44 that demons, when they're cast out, go about in an agitated state of unrest in arid places, in deserts, until they can find another body to inhabit. So they don't like being out of a body. They want to be in bodies. We don't know why. Maybe they used to have bodies. Maybe, I don't know why. But they want to be in a body. Maybe they're just jealous of us. It's a privilege to have a body. So they want to be in a body, and maybe they like that because that way they can intimidate people and they can get people to worship them or whatever. But they had to know Jesus isn't going to let them go into some other body. I mean, some other person. That's not going to work. So maybe they're just trying to get the best concession they can get. We don't know for sure, but the one indication from the text is this. Evidently, it seems that they thought that as long as they could get into another body, they could avoid going to the abyss. And that's their main concern. They just don't want to go there. I don't think they did avoid going to the abyss. I think that's exactly where they were sent. When those pigs perished in the water, I don't think there's any question that, just studying from the Jewish background, that the Jews and the Greeks at that time would have interpreted that as those demons meeting a similar fate and perishing and going to the abyss, which some people believe was at the bottom of the sea. Jesus sent them, I think, to the abyss. The age to come is indeed inaugurated, and Jesus is demonstrating that by plundering Satan's house and devastating his kingdom. So the demons wanted to go into the pigs to avoid the abyss, but it didn't work. Now the other question, though, why did Jesus let them go? Why? Why does he grant their request? Why didn't he just say, no, you can't go in the pigs. You'll go where I tell you to go. You'll go straight to the abyss. Why go through this little deal with all the pigs dying? Some people say it was to teach these people a lesson because pigs are unclean and they shouldn't have had pigs. But keep in mind, these are not Jews, they're Greeks, and Greeks can have pigs if they want. Besides that, shortly after that, Jesus declared all foods clean, even for Jews, in Mark 7:19. And so even after that, even Jews could have pigs if they want. I believe that the reason Jesus granted this request is a very important reason. I'm thankful to God that he granted it. What he's doing is providing evidence for the miracle. Let's think this through for a minute. Some people have wondered whether it was ethical for Jesus to allow these pigs to die. Believe it or not, that's a major discussion in the commentaries, whether that's ethical or not. I've read the arguments along that line, and I have to admit, I still can't see what the problem is with it. Yes, Jesus allowed the pigs to die, but it seems to me he allows all pigs to die. Doesn't he? I mean, there hasn't been an immortal pig yet. Every pig dies. Every animal dies. Even humans die. The question of why God allows death in general is a whole other question, but this isn't anything problematic because death is a reality for every living thing now. Now, Jesus allowed the demons to kill these particular pigs. He allows other things to kill other pigs, but every pig is doomed sooner or later. So it's not a problem. Jesus doesn't kill the pigs. He doesn't order the pigs killed, although I don't even know it would be a problem if he did. He ordered the death of millions of animals that were sacrificed in the temple over thousands of years. But here he allows the demons to kill them. Jesus doesn't prevent the destruction of these demons. That's the way this age is. Jesus doesn't always prevent all of the destructive activities of evil beings. We know that. And there's a very important reason that Jesus had for not preventing this particular destructive activity, because it's important that we notice that the effect these demons have on the pigs is exactly the same effect that the demons had on the man. So we know they're the same demons. You see that? On the man, they made the man a self-destructive maniac. And then as soon as they go into the pigs become self-destructive, maniacal pigs. Pigs can't cut themselves with stones. Best they can do to harm themselves is jumping over. So they do. I think the reason Jesus granted this request is because the demons were asking for something that they thought was advantage, but Jesus knew was to his advantage and to their disadvantage, and so he granted it. You say, wait a minute, how is it to Jesus' advantage? Because it proves the miracle. It proves that Jesus indeed cast the demons out, and it proves that how many demons there are. Jesus says, if Jesus just said, go to the abyss, and they went to the abyss, nobody would see that. Nobody would know if it happened. There'd be no way of knowing the miracle really took place, and there'd be no way of knowing how many demons there were. But if Jesus cast the demons out, and suddenly each one of 2,000 pigs, each one of those pigs has at least one demon, then you know there's proof we're dealing with at least 2,000 demons. And you know for sure they're cast out, and it's the same demons. And by their behavior, you know that. Jesus is just taking the invisible and making it visible for our benefit, so the disciples can see his power. Now you can't deny the miracle. There's no denying this miracle. And people try, they still try, but they have to come up with some pretty bizarre things. Some people I read some commentaries, they try and say, look, there's no miracle here. There's no miracle here. The guy was just insane. And ancient people always thought insanity was the same as demon possession because they didn't understand psychology. And they're just primitive people, and Jesus comes in and accommodates their superstitious beliefs. First of all, Jesus did not come into this world to accommodate himself to our erroneous beliefs about spiritual things. He came in here to this world to be the light of the world and lead us into truth. Secondly, Jesus believed, there's no question, Jesus actually believed in demons and the devil, personal devil, dominated his teaching. The idea that this man was just mentally ill and that there's actually no demons is completely ruled out by what Jesus did. That's exactly the reason Jesus let them go into the pigs. How else are we going to explain what happened to those pigs? How are we going to explain that? I mean, if you want to be skeptical about this miracle, you have to explain the amazing coincidence of a dangerous, maniacal, raving lunatic with superhuman strength instantaneously being transformed with one word from Jesus, and at that same split second, 2,000 nearby pigs immediately, instantaneously develop a severe case of acute, clinical, bipolar, manic, depressive, suicidal psychosis. What a coincidence. How often do entire herds of pigs simultaneously and instantaneously develop severe mental disorders and become suicidal at the exact same moment that a lunatic becomes mentally sound? That's supposed to be a naturalistic explanation of this miracle so that we don't have to believe in the supernatural? And by the way, pigs are not like lemmings. They don't just follow each other off a cliff and commit mass suicide. That is not normal behavior for pigs. And also, I was reading in my encyclopedia about pigs. You know something interesting? Did you know that pigs can swim? Pigs are actually strong swimmers. Even if these pigs did get freaked out and confused, whatever, they jumped into they would have just swum to the shore and climbed out. But these pigs all drown. Now, why did they drown? Pigs can swim. Why did they drown? Because demonized pigs can't swim. In their state of ecstatic frenzy, they drown. There just is no naturalistic explanation that makes any sense. You say, well, did anybody besides the disciples witness this? Yes, the people tending the pigs. Now, I don't know how many people it takes to tend 2,000 pigs, but some kind of a group. Verse 14 talks about those people. It says, those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and the countryside. They watched this whole thing. They ran and they went and told everybody what happened, going to all the farms and everything else. Now, even if they split up and did that, this is going to take some time, probably hours. Matthew tells us what took place in the meantime. This man who was healed was sitting at Jesus' feet. That's the posture of a disciple. He's sitting there learning. Jesus is teaching him. Say, what is he teaching him? Same thing he taught everybody. Kingdom of God. Salvation. The gospel. Luke 8:36 says this man was saved. And verse 14 says, and the people went out to see what had happened. All these people came to see. Now you have all the people from the community. And they came to Jesus, verse 15, and saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there dressed and in his right mind. The man is just perfectly normal and calm. He's just speaking in a plain, normal voice. He's dressed. He's talking, laughing, making intelligent conversations. He's just a regular guy all of a sudden. And look at verse 15. And they were what? Afraid. And that's the same word used in chapter 4, verse 41 of the disciples' fear after Jesus calmed the storm. Now it's their turn to be gripped with fear in the face of deity. Verse 16, those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. They give a full description of everything that happened. Now, what's their response going to be? What are these people going to do from this community? They've just been delivered from the worst plague you can imagine in their community. They've been in the grip of the fear of the devil, and demons have dominated them and intimidated them and assaulted their well-being. And along comes Jesus with one word, eliminates the whole plague, the whole problem. He swept the devil out of Palestine. Now he comes and sweeps him out of the Decapolis. How are they going to react? Gratitude? Are they going to be thankful? Are they going to fall down and worship? When they see this transformed man and his transformed heart, are they going to cry out for the salvation of their own souls and say, transform us too? Will they plead with Jesus to save them? Well, they plead with Jesus, but not to save him. Let's look at their people's plea. Verse 17, then the people began to plead. Same word as beg, used for the demons. Exact same word for the demons begging. They begged Jesus to leave their region. Get out. Jesus was rejected in Jerusalem, rejected in Judea, rejected in Galilee, rejected by the Jewish leaders, rejected by his family, and they had blasphemed him, called him a lunatic. Now he goes over to Gentile country, and he does this wonderful act of mercy, and they say, get out of here. Get out. Why? Why? Some people say, well, it's because of the pigs. 2,000 pigs, that's a lot of money. Today, in today's economy, that would be six figures. And they're mad about the pigs. They're so mad about the pigs, they wanted to leave. Problem with that theory is that there, none of the accounts in Scripture say one word about anger. It doesn't say they were mad. There's no anger is never even mentioned. Nor is anything said about the owners of the pigs. For all we know, they're not even there. This is not the owners of the pigs. These are the surrounding people who lived in the community. And we don't have to guess why they wanted Jesus to leave, because Luke tells us in Luke 8:37. It says, then all the people, the region of the Gerasenes, asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. That's why. Fear. Not anger. This is the fear of unbelief. They can see his power, but they're absolutely blind to his love. You say, but that's irrational. Yes, he's powerful, but it's a good power. He used it to save them, to deliver them. It's a benevolent kind of power. Why are they afraid? Well, that's how it is with unbelief. It's hopelessly irrational and unreasonable. The freeing of the demoniac meant nothing to them, nor did their own liberation. That's the way it is with man. Man would have Christ free him, and then they tell Christ to leave. People want to enjoy benefits from God, pile on the blessings of God, but stay away. Rejection of Christ by mankind is impossible to understand outside of the fact that man is just so desperately immersed and saturated in sin that his heart is utterly wicked. And so when he sees perfect beauty, he hates it. Sinful man recoils in the face of holiness. Jesus was holier than them and purer than them and better than them and cleaner than them and more righteous, and they resented it. So he offers deliverance, but they preferred their old situation. And it's kind of interesting how people do that. You know, people tend to develop a strange attachment to their painful circumstances, even if it's a kind of bondage that they despise. They still cling to it. These people's lives were harmed and threatened by these demons, but it was a threat that they were used to. They understood the boundaries of it. They knew how to steer clear of it. Life with the demons was lousy, but at least somewhat manageable and predictable. But when Jesus came along, he came along with something scarier than demons. And that is the unknown. I mean, this man shows up out of nowhere. All of a sudden, things are happening that are unexplained. Demons are behaving in strange ways, begging, going into pigs. Yesterday, they just had one maniac in the tombs. But today, they have thousands of demons, pigs in the sea, demoniac sitting calmly at Jesus' feet. Who knows what's next? I mean, what's next? Who knows what might come out of the mountains or out of the sea? Or who knows what Jesus might expose right in their very village? There's no telling. And that's the whole problem with Christ. There's just no telling what he's going to do next. John 3 says the work of God is like the wind that blows wherever it wants and can be heard but not seen. It's unpredictable. It's unmanageable. It's outside of our ability to manipulate. And very often we prefer in our lives manageable bondage to unpredictable freedom. So we hold God at arm's length. Henry Ward Beecher, commenting on this, said, "Out of blind terror, they besought this too powerful visitor to depart out of their neighborhood." He's just too powerful. He makes us uncomfortable. So we ask him to leave. Now look at the Lord's response to them in verse 18. Jesus, in verse 18, is getting into the boat. They begged him to leave. He said, okay, and left. And never came back. Beecher went on to say, "He who commanded the storm to be still laid no violence upon the hearts of men." Be careful about holding God at arm's length in your life. One day you may turn and find he's no longer there, and that you've been given over to your sin. Jesus turns his back and leaves, never comes back. So we've seen the demons beg, and we've seen the people beg, but now there's one more person who does a little begging, the man. Look at the man's plea. And this is, again, the same word for begging. Verse 18, "The man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him." This man is different from the rest. He wants to be with Jesus. He can't be close enough to Jesus. He's going to leave his home, his everything he knows, everything he's familiar with. He doesn't have any attachment to anything there. He just wants to be with Jesus. And in the midst of rejection, there's always some whose hearts the Lord will soften. The Lord responds in verse 19, Jesus did not let him. No. For the first time, Jesus says no. Three times in this passage, there's begging. You have these people, the demons first beg for something, and Jesus says yes and grants their request. And then the demons beg, or the people beg for something. The evil, rejecting, vile people beg for Jesus to leave, and he says yes and grants their request. And then the one righteous person in the passage begs for Jesus for something, something good, and Jesus says no. The only person that does not get his prayer answered is the only godly one. There's such an important lesson in that for us. Do you know that sometimes the greatest judgment God can bring on a person is to answer his prayer yes and grant his request? And sometimes the greatest act of mercy and love that God ever shows us is to say no to something that we beg for. Aren't you glad that God is sovereign in answering our prayers, and he's not just a machine who gives us what we want, regardless of whether or not in the long run it would do us harm? He only does what's best, and sometimes in his loving kindness he's faithful to say no to us when we ask for something that's ultimately harmful. And in his perfect sternness with the unrighteous, sometimes in his wrath he will say yes to their request that is ultimately harmful to them. So this guy does not get to go with Christ. He has to stay in this place where, that has completely rejected Christ. Verse 19, Jesus says to the man, "Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord," Luke says, "how much God has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." You can't come with me. I want you to stay here and be a missionary to these people. There's no believers here. Everyone regards you as a demented lunatic, and they absolutely hate me, and I would like you to stay here and be a missionary to them. Goodbye. I mean, this guy has been a believer for less than a day. He has no Bible degree, no training, no support, no church, no Christian friends, no Bible, no materials, no tracts, no financial support. Jesus just said, "You're on your own. Evangelize this area. I'm going back to Jerusalem, or to Israel." You read that and you may still feel sorry for the guy at first, but there's no need to, because salvation always comes, always carries with it the responsibility to testify to this world what Christ has done in you. In Israel, Jesus often told people not to say anything. When he healed them, he said, don't tell anybody, because that just created more problems for Jesus and his ministry. But here, he lets this guy. He says, go ahead and tell. I don't know if it's because they weren't in Israel or whatever, but he lets the guy do what in Israel would only take place after, in the book of Acts, after Jesus left. But there's no need to feel sorry for the guy. As Christians, the issue isn't what we want, what's comfortable for us. That's never the issue. The issue is only what does the master desire. And this man is in a perfect place because he knows exactly what his Lord requires of him. Jesus had mercy on the man, and he had mercy on those people as well by leaving him there. Jesus could have brought the man with and left those people with no witness. But he leaves them with a missionary and a good one. Verse 20, so the man went away and began to tell the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. He doesn't just tell his family, he tells the whole Decapolis, 10 city area. And all the people were amazed. And I have a couple of sources that say that later on, the church, that area there became a stronghold for the early church. Evidently, this man had great success, even in a place that had rejected Jesus. Verse 21, when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was at the lake. Now we have another big event that's about to happen. Now what? Well, that's next time. For now, just ask yourself, as we've seen these three pleas, ask yourself, what is your plea to God? I want you to think deeply about this. Some people are like the demons. Don't make me suffer anything, just give me what I want. Beware. He may say yes to that prayer. Some others are like these people. Don't rock the boat in my life. I don't want any danger in my life. I don't want any risk. I don't want any uncertainty. I don't want any turbulence. Be careful. He may say yes to that request. Others are like this man, transformed, sitting at his feet, desiring nothing more than intimate fellowship with Christ and closeness with him. And Jesus might say no. Allow a time of dryness and distance. And he may call you into something hard. What is your plea this morning? Whatever your plea is with God, whatever you're begging God for this morning, I hope you remember that he is utterly sovereign in answering prayers and can be counted on to answer them the right way. Always. As soon as you pray, you can have peace fill your soul, not because you know you're going to get what you ask for. The reason the peace floods into your soul right away after you pray is because you know from that moment on that you can trust him. You can trust in his faithfulness. You can trust him to be faithful, to do what's best in response to your requests, whether it be yes or no.